All right, so those of you who don't know, the idea here is essentially most of us are grad students in this environmental studies department. We come here from various corners of the continent or the globe, and we all bring these different places with us. We bring these different loves and sort of feelings of conflict of these places. And then several of us are trying to kind of write through that, write about that. And we then sort of start to get to know each other on how we write, get to know each other on how we feel about our homes, how we feel about the future. And so to introduce Erica, one thing I think for a lot of us, it's been wonderful to have someone who is really not afraid of writing from a really like vulnerable place of tenderness and of love and care, but that's also a source of strength. That it's not weak to be loving, it's not weak to care so much that it makes you sad sometimes. So really just happy to be sharing this year here with Erica. Speak for a lot of us when I say that, and happy to hear her read some of these words tonight. So, here's Erica, everybody.
Thank you, Trevian. This first piece I'm gonna read, I've been working on for quite some time. I wrote it my senior year of undergrad, and have since torn it apart and restructured it and torn it apart again multiple times. And I put a lot of work into it, so I hope you enjoy. Dixie Dog. I prayed they'd let me keep you. I remember when we found you, dodging in between cars and fallen palm trees on old Dixie Highway. The sky and earth melted together through thick strokes of rain. We pulled off the road and opened the car door and scooped you up out of the rising tide. We were dealing with another storm, dealing with power outages and sunken roofs. Everything was crumbling. You couldn't have come at a better time. Your fur, matted in thick lumps around your neck and legs, held your withered body together. You soaked into my lap and we watched the rain come down in hopeful silence as Dad drove us home through flooded streets. We sat together on the pink, moldy couch in the garage, eating cold hot dogs while the adults talked loudly about whether or not you should stay. Dad and me picked burrs and pieces of shingle out of your paws for what felt like hours. We washed you white again and combed your knots and kinks until I could run my fingers through your fur freely. You were the perfect little shrub. You sat and let me trim and snip until my fingers cramped. A beautiful patchwork you were. I put bows in your hair, the way Mom had shown me how to put them in mine. The neighbors thought you had mange. I was so proud of you, though. You were so patient. I think you loved Dad as much as I did. Each evening, we'd sit on the pink, moldy couch in the garage and wait for him to get home, perking our ears at the sound of diesel trucks rumbling by. He threw the ball the farthest and gave you the meat he burnt. He caught the lizards you chased. Swiftly and gently, he'd detangle them from the burnt summer grass, careful not to pinch their tails or grip their soft bellies too firmly. "Look here," he said. "Look at its scales." He'd crack open his cupped hand and trace the ridge along the lizard's back. "Like a dinosaur," I said. "Yes," he replied, "just like a dinosaur." We would watch, mesmerized, as he cradled the lizard in one hand and caressed its pointy head with the other. Its crimson throat flexed, its wild eyes lulled with each stroke of his finger. "Why does she want to kill it?" I asked. "Because," he said, "she doesn't know not to kill something so beautiful." I clung to you during the divorce, crying into your woolly neck. You never fought my grip, no matter how tight. I whispered senseless prayers into your ear. "Dear God," I'd sigh, and you'd listen. When Dad moved out, I ran through the tomato fields like a wild animal, pulling up stakes and stabbing them back into the earth until my palms bled. You chased me, never letting me out of your sight. You licked blood off my hands when I collapsed, coughing and spitting into the dirt with defeat. The stepdad moved in and lined the garage with deer heads and spit cups. The couch began to reek of cigarettes and old wine. He swung his muddy boots at you, and I wrapped myself around his leg and sank my teeth through his dirty jeans and his meaty calf. They called me wild. "Out of control," they said. I got whipped for the first time. He didn't swing at you again, though. He found a new target. When the new baby came, you had to stay outside. Put the dumb old baby out, I said. She's the one that stinks. They took me to my room and told me to stay there. I ran through the tomato fields, pulling fruit off the vine and stomping on it. You watched. I kept the lizards you killed in my desk at school. My hands would find them during science class. And I would rub my thumb over their bony skulls. I'd close my eyes and I'd pray for them to move again. Mrs. Overteen found them. She called Mom and we had a meeting in a room with child-sized dolls sitting next to me. The adults asked me what was wrong. They asked me why I would do something like that, keep dead lizards in my desk. They asked about Dad. They called me stubborn. They wouldn't give the lizards back. I held you tight that night and dreamt of taming dinosaurs. I walked around the yard, calling for you. Dixie girl, Dixie girl. But you didn't come. I thought you had run away, left me. I threw your food bowl against the side of the house and swore loudly. And then I saw you, your fuzzy little legs sticking out from behind the shed. You were falling apart in so many ways. Your eyes, glazed over, hung soft and heavy. Your breath was short and sharp. Something had gotten hold of you. One of the stray packs the Mexicans fed, or Thomas Wright's dog that had to be chained because it had killed too many cats. Your fur, your beautiful cotton fur, was caked over with dirt and blood. I scooped you up and carried you into the kitchen. I cried for them to drive us to the vet. We didn't go. I wrapped you in one of Dad's old shirts and carried you out into the tomato field and lay with you in the dirt. I pressed my hand over your split belly and prayed loud and hard for it to scab over, for things to be as they had been. The dark sky hung over us like a soft, fresh bruise. You stopped wheezing. You grew quiet. I ripped fruit off the vines and pelted them towards the sky like bombs. I stopped praying. Dixie dog. This next piece is a bit longer. It shares a similar theme, I guess, as most of my childhood, which is of storms and rebuilding. And I wrote it last summer, thanks to Phil probing us to kind of reach into these dark places and bring out the hurt. It is called Landfall. They say there is great calm before a storm, but I've never felt it. Tension, silence, stillness maybe, but never calm. When the earth is saturated with water and sewers rise up to meet black clouds, wolf spiders flee from their underground tunnels in search of high ground. They are one of the only spiders to care for their offspring through infancy, one of the only spiders to never abandon their young. A soft silken globe hangs from the mother's underbelly and sways with the weight of several dozen plump eggs that she carries with her everywhere. When the eggs hatch, the babies crawl onto the back of their mother where they stay until they are old enough and strong enough to survive without her. When the rains come, they cling to her sharp, fragile body as she scurries under their weight to find a new dwelling, a place where they will be safe from the world they were born into. I am 13, standing in front of my mother's full-length mirror, naked. Florida summer heat presses hard against the house, seeping in through thin walls. It's hurricane season. The window unit chugs and sputters in an attempt to trim thick waves of heat into wisps of cool relief. It's failing. The air is stagnant. My hands and armpits are clammed with sweat. My body is ashen and blurred against the sickly pink bathroom walls reflecting in the mirror. The shower drips uninterrupted. It's the first time I've seen my body in full length for some time. The landscape has changed dramatically. Baby fat clings to large curves that should be sharply defined by now. Other areas are overdeveloped, underdeveloped, misshaped, and awkward. I wonder how this would be divided on a butcher's chart. Dense shoulders, A rigid square chest with two banana boobs splayed in opposite directions. A deep belly button, all rest on two giant loaves of raw dough. Parts that were once taut move and jiggle. Things are not so uniform anymore. I put on my clothes and make my way to the backyard where my mother is waiting with splintered wood and rusty screws. A storm is coming. My mother is crouched at the foot of an unbalanced ladder. The dirt is littered with a fresh deposit of her morning cigarette butts. Puffed pouches of sleeplessness rest loosely under her eyes. A storm is pressing down on the Bahamas, clearing a path to the tip of South Florida. It's due to make landfall tomorrow evening. We have 10 windows to board up. We aren't speaking. The yard smells of decay. Garbage overflows from crinkled aluminum drums resting against the side of the house. Piles of dry white dog shit and abandoned Tonka trucks interrupt the flat earth. Lost marbles cling to lips of dirt and reflect the midday sun like stars in a night sky. I pick up a board of plywood. Its edges sharp and uneven, cut into my palms. My grip is weak. I press it against the sun-bleached stucco and wait for my mother to drill last season's screws into the wood. We do this for 4 hours in silence. We are interrupted by the babies. They roll through the yard like tumbleweeds, an entanglement of arms and legs, kicking and screaming and slapping. My mother stops our work to separate the babies and disappears into the house with the youngest one clinging to her leg in tears. The five-year-old, the winner, a girl, picks up the abandoned drill and begins driving it into the dirt. Her curls are matted against the back of her neck in layers of sweat. She is focused, licking at the crust of nose drippings on her upper lip, drilling into the earth beneath her bare feet. A strap of her faded blue tank top droops off her shoulder. "Allie," I call to her. "Allie, don't do that." She ignores me with such deft I wonder if I've spoken out loud. I sit on a broken edge of concrete jutting out from beneath the house and watch her. There is a shift in the air. Not movement, not wind, just a light ease of pressure as clouds move over the noon sun. "Allie," I say again. Nothing. "We have to prepare for the worst," a news anchor announces over the store speakers. The voice echoes through a grid of empty aisles. It's a hit that dominates the top of the charts each August. Every radio station has played it repeatedly for the last 4 days. It's the season for panic. I am 15, waiting for my mother to cash a check at the customer service desk. I have the youngest baby resting on one hip and a bag of canned goods digging into the other. Birds flutter and chirp through the rafters above me, cutting the rain of incandescent glow with their soft shadows. The shelves have been mobbed. The floor is veined with scuff marks and swirls of week-old dust. The produce section yields overpowering ripeness. A box of batteries has been slashed and partially pocketed, leaving half the pack scattered in front of the checkout line. The batteries roll like marbles across the stained linoleum. The air smells of abandon. A bagger pushes a cart of empty crates and kicks the batteries out of his way as he passes. A storm is coming. The woman standing in line in front of my mother eclipses the register with a small gang of toddlers and demands to know how the fuck a grocery store can run out of diapers the day before a hurricane. The cashier picks up the phone and announces that assistance is needed. Assistance is needed. I readjust the sack of child on my hip and walk to the front of the store to examine the storm preparedness display that greets a steady flow of desperate shoppers. Three science boards line a card table, creating a mini theater featuring previous disasters. A red, hard font stamps the unbounded question, "Are you prepared?" Snapshots of the 92 storm remind passersby of the potential this season holds. The photos show a line of men filed around my elementary school gym. They are holding empty milk jugs and paint buckets, waiting for water rations and packets of macaroni. Uprooted trees wrapped in streamers of sheet metal decorate the streets of downtown. Overturned cars balance atop one another like Jenga pieces. Pleas of help bleed into shingleless roofs. I untack the picture of the men from the board and examine their faces. None of the men are looking at the camera. Their eyes are dazed and distant, post-traumatic. There is urgency in their stance. Though they may not thirst for knowledge, they are seeped in it. They are deflated, winded, wide-eyed children being schooled in the basics of third-worldliness. They've shown up to this school with all the supplies needed. Uniforms of sleeveless, torn tank tops and bleach-stained jeans dress them in acceptance. Buckets swing from limp fingers like empty backpacks, waiting to be filled with the weight of expectation and relief. It is not just a matter of showing up and receiving these gifts of knowledge. They must decide how to utilize them, how to meet the demands of filth and thirst, kids and wives and self. These men are so familiar to me. They are my uncles and neighbors and father. They will all go back to their tents, their campers, the beds of semi-trucks and storage units, their cots and sleeping bags and musty mattresses. They will divide the water into pots over open flames, boil ramen in it, stain it with tea and instant coffee and infant formula, dip their hands and wash their faces. It will be soiled come morning, and they will taste destitution once again. Their salvation will be fleeting, evaporating, drying up. They will be angry and frustrated for not having mastered the lesson of rationing, for not having been prepared for the worst, because surely this is the worst. Surely this is the bottom. Their faces say it, scream it as they look away from the camera. We have nowhere to go but up, I remember them chanting sheepishly. What more can we lose? They asked. And God answered. He took their marriages, their youth, their jobs, their industry, their sobriety. The men were left with running water and soft beds and quiet homes. The women with armfuls of babies and tender cheekbones. And the lesson was learned. My mother shoves me from the photo. The baby is crying. Can you not hear the goddamn baby crying? She asks, unpeeling him from my side and turning hard through the automatic doors. She is still clutching the check in her hand, and I know we are not prepared for anything. I am 17, sitting on a braided rug in my mother's living room, watching people spill out around the Superdome like ants, like spiders. The television flashes with housetops peeking out of a great body of water. Oak trees float down highways like twigs in a gutter. Families crowd atop roofs and wave their broken wings. It is as if the perpetrator of a great assault has walked through the door and demanded that I look him in the face. And I do. I cannot look away. For more than a decade, we held the trophy of broken homes. The 92 storm was the most devastating storm to have ever hit the U.S., and we survived it. We were number one in something. We held on to that title and shook it in the faces of school reformers and social workers, civil courts and building inspectors. We balled it up and shoved it down the throats of criticism. Watching the screen, I realize that we are again displaced. No longer entitled to wallow in poverty or inherit Section 8 housing with victimized reticence. Now we must be mobile, for the light shines on a fresher wound. The lens has refocused, and by God, they are drowning in their own shit. The babies are not babies anymore. They stand in front of the television screen and demand to know when they can watch Nickelodeon. They are dumb to the history that is unfolding within their own story. They are products of natural disaster, born out of the eye of these storms. Their cells fused under gaping holes in a collapsed ceiling, outside of a marriage whose guts and balls had been ripped from its body and cast into a pile of shattered hearts and broken plywood. My mother leans over a cold cup of coffee and rubs her temples. Go to your room, she tells them passively. The news anchors are convinced that the storm has passed, that the water will recede and everyone will go back to their homes and rebuild. They are repeating it over and over. We will rebuild, they say. Their faces are swollen with emotion and defiance. I look at my mother and know that she is watching this disaster unfold through seasoned eyes. It is one of the few things we both understand. There will be no rebuilding. On the news, they call the storm a monster. But they are mistaken. When the waters recede and the looting begins, when sexual battery ripples through the campsites, when divorce papers are filed and new marriage certificates are signed, when the FEMA checks run dry and the rain turns to whiskey, that is when the monsters wash up on shore. The real storm is still brewing. It is gaining traction in the pulse of blooming poverty. And when it lands, no one will be watching. I am 5 years old, standing on shards of what used to be a swing set. My oldest sister is squatting over a 5-gallon bucket, humming Sesame Street, pissing. We are not to leave each other's sight. She is slow and whiny and cries when we find baby dolls that are broken beyond repair. She spends the evening rubbing the doll's cheeks with my father's hanky. Sitting with my mother in our tent, she brushes their tangled hair and adjusts their ratty clothes in a trance of triage. I'm looking for marbles. The houses have all collapsed, and with them, jars and jars of marbles have been shattered, their contents rolling and lost amongst the debris. It's your job to find them, my dad says to me. Because when we rebuild and everyone comes back, the children are going to want to know what happened to their marbles. And I'll have them all. I'll wait for the children in front of the neighborhood with all the jars of marbles I've filled, and I'll hand them back one by one as the families file past me to their new homes. So far, I've found 6. They clink together in the plastic grocery bag slung over my shoulder. It's a dangerous job looking for marbles and baby dolls. Nails and glass form terrain children's shoes weren't meant to endure. We're not to wander too far from the tents. We're not to touch any animals. Should a dog approach us, we are to yell at it, kick it if we must, and come straight back to tell the adults. Against my mother's objection, I've been given a pocket knife. We haven't received our shots yet. Talks of tetanus and rabies have circulated through camp. Across the rubble, the frame of a 2-story house stands tall, shooting up from a sea of splintered lumber and crumbled walls. It is defiant against the cloud-torn August sky. The garage door swings on a solitary creaking hinge like a white flag of surrender. I clamber through the jungle of drywall and rebar to meet the longest shadow I've stood under in days. The roof is gone, lost amongst thousands of shingles littering the yard. Fiberglass hangs limply from the rafters like an unraveled web, still dripping with coastal rain. In the distance, I can hear my sister calling me. Her voice echoes off the cement piles, looking for a soft place to land. She does not want to be alone in the rubble. She is afraid of getting trapped in the labyrinth of debris. She is afraid of the dogs and the wind and the clouds that won't leave. I can hear the panic in her voice. Walls are still collapsing. We've heard them at night from our tents. The stillness of the earth will crack in the distance, and another house will fall. My mother has warned us of these houses, the ones that seem to have endured the worst. They are the weakest, she says. Their frames are fractured. They will be bulldozed and rebuilt from nothing. Stay away from them, we're warned. But the house is open, gaping, caged only by ribs of steel and concrete. I fumble up the 3 steps leading to the mouth of the house and stand at the threshold. The plastic grocery bag of marbles flutters under my arm like a trapped bird. The floor is impenetrable, lined with waterlogged clothes, swollen fragments of furniture, and shreds of snowy insulation. Something is rotting nearby. I rub my shoe across the entrance, clearing a thick skin of dust off the broken tile. I trace a foot-long circle in the grime, reach my hand in the bag, drop the marbles into the circle, and begin to play. Thank you. I am not as eloquent as Trevian in my introduction, so I wrote something which I will be reading for him. I cannot go off the top of my head like that. When you've reached a place in your relationship with the written word, And you find yourself walking down the dry desert road of prose and thirsty poetry. Stick out your thumb, climb into the old Volkswagen, and join this man on a drive into a world filled with sacred caves, unbeaten paths, and hollow night skies, while sprouting and sowing seeds of change along the way. Please welcome tree planter, activist, friend and fellow human being, Trevian Stenger.
Well, the fat king of gods, the breaker of bones, owns everything you see for endless miles. But when talk of revolution vanishes under stones, the mystic sees it trembling and he smiles. Liberty's children build prison on prison, try to rid us of violence with bombs. But anyone who goes where the wild wind blows knows where we be without our loving moms. Now, I know that might sound too dainty, but still I'd repeat it, because even the slightest truths shall not be defeated. And it's a far cry, at least, from the daily deceit that we play, and we play like it's stuck on repeat. And peace has no leaders to play its cards, and peace will pay its own leader's price. But the tombs will be empty as it flows from the bards. Play it smooth, like a tune that's nice. And slowly but surely, the world revolves. I know that grace will be her own resolve. And she will dance at any chance aloft until all of the world's problems are solved. And the capitalist masturbates, dreaming of Ayn Rand. And the philosopher wonders what he won't be when he's dead. And the artist asks God to flow from his hand. And the pacifist asks Hitler, just what if I said? And the journalist keeps a day job, waving like a sea, like a parade of princesses down the middle of Maine. And the one they locked up for feeling too free, I hope he never stops laughing at those ridiculous chains. That is the work of a folk singer from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia named Nathan Moore, hero of mine. Poem for our winter evening, stopping by woods on a snowy evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and snowy lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. And the only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep, miles to go before I sleep, miles to go before I sleep. So Robert Frost wrote that in 1923, and I redid it for 2012, starting by mind on a stony evening. Whose mind this is, I think I know. His heart is fully empty, though. He will not sense me stopping here to watch his thoughts bloom and grow. My little voice must think it queer to stop without a listener near. Between the moods of blowing fate, my darkest musings of the year. I give my harnessed head a shake to remember I am no mistake. The only other sounds the creep of easy winds and dusky slate. The one mind is lovely, dark, and deep. But I have illusions to keep, and miles to go before I wake, and miles to go before I wake. Thanks. All right, so I'm gonna read mostly through that strange other stream we call poetry. And just a word on that, if prose as indeed a very perfect tool for perfect jobs, much like architecture, rewards linear thought, and following really good, crisp rules, poetry instead would be observing the river, noting that somehow coyote is in it. Okay, so that being said, don't feel like you have to know what's going on the whole time. You are free to. If anything, if you did know, that would freak me out because. Nice. But sometimes they're straight ahead too. Here's the first poem I wrote upon getting into the Missoula Valley. It's called Arrowheads. The oohs, the ahs, the how deep is it of 20 sixth graders. Banks of the Bitterroot River, frost on the willow spears, reflecting in the shallows. Two kids run up to me. One clearly of the native Salish. One freckled with mixed American-Irish. Look, we found an arrowhead. So pausing my semi-educational riparian riffing, I inspect the rock, a heavy, uncarved triangle of granite. They stare up at me, these natives of now, awaiting my confirmation. With gentle inspection, I hold the rock up to the big skylight with the sharp end down. One corner points to the Irish face. One corner points to the Salish. And the arrow tip correctly pointing at this river, still flowing. What will it do, I ask, truly not knowing. So, one word of thanks would certainly be to the very fact this is going on. Go however far upstream you want to give thanks, starting with Creator on down to the fact that this is a really sweet university, a really cool little program within it. Much thankfulness to the teachers who helped bring us all here in some way or another, teachers throughout our lives, and to us to be able to pass that on. And you get to be the primary ambassador of that right now, Phil. So thanks to Phil. It's called Love Poem for Han Shan. Han Shan was a 8th century Zen lunatic.
As opposed to 21st century Zen.
Yep. To be this lustful of wandering, to be this dedicated to a simple backpack, to stand guard against those forces that wish to say, you there, that's enough, you're done. Surrender to these fences. Open the floodgates to possessions. You're done. What is this life of age counting and paperwork? Not fear, really, just repulsion. I have thorns protecting, ready to tear against credit card flesh. Though some mornings I am the prey, ever watchful, ears pricked, listening for the crackle of swooshing logo stalking. My heart another possible feast for profit. Just last night, it was I on the prowl, as I stared into the eyes of another angry product of a man. Incredulous, I'd asked him to please not throw cigarette butts into our shared streets, streams. His expensive cologne roiled with cheap testosterone, his fists curled into horror that someone dares to care. So I glared back with the wild fangs of a complete and honest smile of forgiveness, to which he had no defense. I smote him with love, devoured his ignorance, and left a steaming scat of compassion upon his trembling feet. So I stole away, past the barcodes and darkened shops, climbed my favorite roof beneath a wampum belt of cloud and a copper moon. Oh, and a true love poem, though. Be my honeybee. I start a buzz again, this honeybee heart. Taking your clothes off the writhing laundry line, a bird-winged breeze ruffles your flower print shirt. Pollen swarms my wings to hive, floating inside toward dandelion dark, to drink, to drunk, soused in your nectar. So sweet and so tart. And now a series of very short poems. I don't mind the town, but way up here, cliffs and clouds, I think further. Peeling paper skin, dog-eared book covers, day drunk and chatting. Mother, do we have any carrots? My snowman smells nothing. Gimmicky. This here is more emphasis than content. Try this. I have no idea what's gonna happen. I mean, I don't even buy green bananas anymore. So encourage me. Considering the heart is designed to beat only so many times, it's hard not to skip, serious, down the gravel road. This is called the walk back. If we found, perhaps within an autumn leaf pile, another hour, would we still be home by dark? One more short one here. The road atlas. The road atlas, coffee stained and tattered, contains within it tens of thousands of miles. Towns that you'll never see. The road atlas is an idea crammed right now in the back of your car waiting for you. It has a crush on you. It wants to tell you all about itself and show you its paper heart. All right, and then in honor of things being rough and quick and willing to try new things, here's something I put out today. Hence, didn't even print out. Started, the first few lines were, several of us are in a class with Jeannie Saray, a wonderful writer of the South who's here as a visiting professor this semester, and she gave us one prompt of, what I want to tell you is. So I had a few lines in that, and I decided to revisit that today. What I want to tell you is that I've seen a crackling, shimmering reality. I've seen a place where the density of data is like a tree with 10,000 leaves, each with their own set of sunny side and underside species. I've seen a place where the water pervades and permeates every niche available, where it is the real and metaphor of spirit irrigating form. I've seen a place where the creatures have taken on lives of their own and are rearing and devouring each other with mercy and grace. A place where the thick, quaking sounds of avalanches and thunderstorms coexist with the dull thumps of heartbeats within babies' chests, alongside the million-chink splash of broken glass with the skittering of crabs and silent sand and humid lagoons. A place where spirit constantly and incessantly animates an electric biosphere that trembles in constant birth. A place where the people are, always and unequivocally, leaning forward from the front edge of their own evolution. A place where the people are naked under their clothes, and then further in, naked under their culture. I've seen their nudity to be a molten, pulsing lotus of light, a fire they did not start and they could never extinguish, only relinquish. A place where the people walk through a thick, sensuous realm in which their sensorial apparatus takes similar shape to their four-legged and winged cousins, a place where those are all but slim possibilities of the potential awareness, a place where the whole of the universe, with impunity and at will, can concentrate its focus through a pair of human eyes, an aperture through which the universe, with its stars, ferns, and mountains, can become aware of itself. I've seen a place where words can create and destroy trophic cascades, streams, mountains, and forests decimated by a thought, pipelines, mines, clear cuts halted with an idea. I've seen a place where the land shapes the creatures, and they in turn shape the land, where streams lose meanders when they lose wolves, where oceans lose kelp forests when they lose otters, where people lose sanity, where their guiding stories lose sanctity. I've seen a place where people, lush, vibrant, life-quaking people, sit in chairs. Their bodies with sexual organs and sense organs and their empathy organs all tuning them to their moment. Their minds and their identities and their dreams and loves tuning them to their moment. I've seen how all of them can get together to concentrate their focus and their energy. I've seen a place where that energy undermines injustice, threatens entrenched paradigms, distills abstractions into actions, pummels ignorance with love, propagates awareness through poetry, and scares the shit out of those who would rather such groups of people never met up. I've seen a place where the language can, will, and must continue on its inevitable evolution, turning itself further toward the beauty that inspired its rise. I've seen a place where wildness was not banished, but invited. I've seen a place where that idea alone was enough to keep the dream dreaming, keep it burning very, very bright. Burning it, as a small crew for another night. Thanks. All right. Thank you all for listening. Hope you all can feel this feeling sometime in your life. It's really hard to take credit for much of what we do when you really kind of trace back its origins. So enjoying being a vessel right now for y'all. I'd like to call up another brilliant human, wonderful vessel. I got this friend here named Skander, and he plays an instrument. He's gonna come accompany me. Skander, everybody. Enjoying this, you should come every Thursday. We have many other wonderful people who are going to read. Nick, are you reading next week?
Yeah.
Lovely. Who else?
Lily.
Great. Lily here? This Saturday, you should know that we're going to go be a group of minds and voices at a rally / meeting at the courthouse for the Blue Skies campaign against this possibility of coal trains coming through.
More
coal trains coming through.
So, I play the cello, and I really like that. My cello turned 100 years old this year. This is its first. This is its first performance being a centenarian.
Y'all been able to hear me okay in the back?
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, remember when I said it's okay if you don't follow everything? That's true with what we're about to do. Okay, just that's a green light to do what you want to do with it. But this is something that does come from my heart. Wrote kind of in a space of a few nights after returning from a particular pummeling hitchhiking journey, and for a long time I've wondered how to read it, and I think this is it, with this delightful young man and this incredible old instrument. It's called Die Slow. I'm becoming too dense within myself. These landscapes just keep piling up. I attend to the present, and it continues to sweep the broom across the dust and reveal these ice-hard surfaces of places past. Moments keep splintering. I'm too aware. A single place buries me in details, exponential experience growing in thick, fleshy meadows. Crawling on bloody knees, I die slow. I worry I may only live in a kind of memory. My end time is coming. I am to sit by the peeling tide and think blink for days, dying by living. As this world I've seen swells and thrusts itself out of my effacing heart, I cannot bear these rushes any longer. I die slow. This gas station store is not even here. I wait in line and become another land. I become another land, one with a breeze from the west and garlands of shadows on the dry creek bed. And there's too much blue above to ever consider trifles of price and white teeth. A single square mile will haunt me for years. The seasons linger longer than they should. I'm more map now than man. My legend is full of archetypes. My longitudes sinuous, my latitudes Precambrian, my topography lines, all eyelash and fox fur. Too much time outdoors is making this impossible. I collapse into an hour of thinking in a chair at night in winter dark. I turn off the lights and pace, watching the glinting stars through the narrow windows. I turn off the lights and pace, watching this mind create summer roadsides, crickets and deer prints and hitchhiking free. I keep the lights off and roam basins and floodplains and alleys and temples I've never seen and likely never will. These earth-sized rushes of size unhindered, size uncompressed, it can hurt, I'm not a big man. The tree I climb is in me, too large to be in me. How are you in me? Canyon knolls and canyon walls knock on my car door. Every single inch of the Winooski Railroad trestle courses through my veins. I bamboo bones. The glacial scourings on a single stone, thrown from my hand in autumn light, skips across the shimmering river surface, creating colorful, concentric rings of tree, sky, ghosts of glaciers. A mile above me once, scour me too. I cannot recall why I hold the outback desert like I do, but the horizontal breadth obliterates my wingspan into something nothing. I remember the first wave I ever surfed. It was turquoise and waist high, warm and quiet, and the secret sound echoes now too. I sense I have coral reefs in the regenerative cells of my knuckles. I scratch my scraggly beard and watch large flecks of granite and shale crumble down into the mud and scree. I hear the Rockies rising in my right ear, and owls melancholy call on my left. I may finally have nothing left. Here lies a Trevian, lost at Earth. My epitaph is a watershed. The sons of all keep daily vigil. My obituary is written by everyone I've ever known or ever will know. They write it every single day. They're writing it and feeling it and calling it memory. It's about everyone they know, and on it flows. With an identity, I've been a dam. With these releases we create. The plot of my grave is covered by seven continents and an embowered lattice of river and ocean. The water above us could come down at any minute. The leaves trickling overhead are under the stars, and I see more leaves beyond them. And every day I'm visited by the animals. All day long they swim and crawl and walk and fly. And all day long they wonder why we keep coming to them to decorate their homes with cutouts of the daily NASDAQ. All day long we whine that we didn't build as many new homes as last year. They know their blood runs through our lumber. They ask something of poets. All night long they are helping me fulfill the will that we all co-authored at birth. Thousands of words in the womb, written on a scroll of birch bark, ink of blood and mucus and sap. Cities are built on the illusion that human communities comprise the majority. This will we're writing seeks a higher audience. So first we hired a mycelium network of minute thread-like filaments as our initial publisher. They send out PR spores through a manna and germinate publicity on too many surfaces to name. I seen a mushroom growing out of the back of an ant once. The ant's last words were, "Destiny is upon us." We published this quote as our mission statement on the murky surface of a summer pond. And all day long the dragonflies flew past like fleshy helicopters. And with kind gaping jaws they snatched whirling gnats. And with curious compound eyes they read the words waving between the frog green lily pads. Then Bullfrog stretched his greasy webbed wet hand and dove beneath. Put down a second membrane over his marble eyes. And did frog kicks toward Turtle to see if she'd heard the news. Turtle had. It was already on the mahogany map of her shell, which she redraws in the sand with one clawed hand every dawn and waits. She's tired of cars, wary of raccoons, and hopeful of small organic farms. Coyote hasn't been seen in weeks. Spider had come down a moon ago to announce that she too was writing the will in gossamer threads, stretching them between the pulsing green stalks of Indian corn in the eastern fields. She cooed that a small human boy had been wandering past last week with a shovel and a journal. And on short legs, he stooped and read the message and had walked away whistling to the last golden slants of the afternoon star. And all night long, the pond drains toward the ocean. And all night long, the will is urged ever and on. Closed hand, with five fingertips touching, pointing upward, then opens like a flower. I fell out of the Great Mother and rolled around in the palm with everyone for so long, I could too easily forget I was in it. We all awoke in the grass on a foggy morning, and every single atom of every single possible form across every medium of matter and thought was all vibrating so perfectly and so fast that it intermeshed to a point of stillness. And we hummed, and we hushed, and we rushed towards something that might open up that rhythm enough to make us feel like there was room for our instrument and our voice to add something to the song. So when we two-leggeds became safe and sheltered and well-fed, we got right to work. Paints and caves and stories through language and communities with wolves for uncles and ferns for advice. Can you see the bind I'm in? I'm bound. With a foot flat on the ground, you can draw a line straight away from you. And eventually, that line will hit you in the heel. I see your lines everywhere. I cannot leave. I know there's water in the air, and I'm soaked. I die slow. I die slow and listen to the train whistle and the dolphin laughter and the suffering whimper of jealousy and phlegm. I die slow and find a good woman with whom I can remember my flesh. I die slow with only occasional regret. I die slow and live alone. I die slow and live inseparably. I die slow and smell the hot, humid rain on the empty street. I die slow and incarnate nothing new. I'm the reincarnation of nothing new. I'm your new memory. I die slow and weep glossy puddles that reflect the guitar and the ageless hands dancing. I die slow and water my plants, shovel the walk, sweep the floor, and sit. I sit slow. I die slow and snowboard powder, paddle water, throw discs, and climb. I die slow and fast night drunks with eternally ephemeral friends and wine. I die slow dark. I wild everything. I die slow to the radio, news of what lives we leave. I die slow and care about leaves. I die slow in every language. I die slow in the snow. I die slow in tide pools, pulled apart by crabs, and swallowed by dreams. I die slow. I'm running out of time. Falling into another palm. I allow us to rest inside my own for perhaps one more sun, one more run. We die slow. We find the edges and report back. Let the word spread to those stuck in the center, even if it falls apart. We do die slow. And I'll be dead. For now, there's air in your lungs. There's a flint spark of the great inspiration glimmering in your eye. It resembles an image of this earth seen from here in our orbit of mind. These words are notes taking shape across the eternal strings of our time. And I'll be dead. That is fine. Die slow. Nice.
Okay. Have a cello, everybody.